From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Happy Halloween, everybody. Next hour, Ghost to Ghost begins. And happy birthday to Natalie Markham, born on Halloween not that long ago. Looking forward to tonight's show. Boy, are some of the emails we received from people who will be on the show, are they amazing ghost stories? Wow. Here's what's happening. Smartphones and tablets in bedrooms disrupt the sleep of children and probably adults, even if they are switched off, according to a new study. Researchers at King's College in London and Cardiff University reviewed 11 studies reviewing more than 125,000 children to find out if this is impacting their sleep patterns. Well, they found that using smartphones or tablets before bedtime doubled the risk of a disrupted night's sleep and raised the chances of excessively sleepy days the following day by even twofold. So, just news you can use. The surprise disclosure that agents from the Federal Bureau of Investigation are taking a new look at Hillary Clinton's email use lays bare, just days before the election, tensions inside the Bureau and the Justice Department over how to investigate the Democratic presidential nominee. Investigators found 650,000 emails on a laptop that they believe was used by former Representative Anthony Weiner and his estranged wife, a close Clinton aide. And underlying data suggests thousands of those messages could have been sent to or from the private server that Mrs. Clinton used while she was the Secretary of State. Now, it's reported that the FBI director is not going to reveal the results of the investigation until after the election. Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi, of course, author of Partners in Crime, the Clinton scheme to monetize the White House for personal profit. Jerry, I'll talk with you about that book in a second. You can give us an update on that. But why make the announcement that there's something somewhat suspicious about the emails and then not release it before the election? Why wait until after?
Well, George, it's a complex story, but it starts with, I started publishing in August. I realized that Huma Abedin, who is a top aide to Hillary Clinton, had a lot of her emails released by Judicial Watch in response to a federally ordered court order that these emails had to be released. And it was clear that Huma Abedin was sending State Department emails. She was forwarding the emails to herself. And the account she was taking emails from both state.gov, which is the State Department computer, and ClintonEmail.gov, which was Hillary's private server, and she was sending them to Huma Abedin at yahoo.com. Now, that was a bombshell recognition, and I know it impacted the FBI. Mm-hmm. Because what it means is that a large quantity of State Department emails were being taken offline completely and archived in Huma Abedin's account in Yahoo, which means that anyone who had the username or password to Huma Abedin's account could read real-time and unredacted all the State Department emails she was archiving on yahoo.com.
All right, so it was foolish, it was probably stupid, but in Hillary Clinton's case, Jerry, is stupidity a defense?
Not in this case, Joseph, because she has a responsibility to make sure that all the emails under her purview are safe from espionage. She's got affirmative responsibilities, and you can't excuse these affirmative responsibilities under the law. Also, some of the emails show that Hillary Clinton was sending emails to Huma Abedin at yahoo.com. So Hillary was also sending offline State Department emails, which, you know, these are crimes. These are the kinds of things, just by the fact of doing them, are crimes. And then the potential is, and we'll only know from Yahoo, whether or not, say, a foreign source accessed
That's right.
And Yahoo will have the IP address of everybody who looked at it. Yahoo will not release that data unless there's a subpoena, which the FBI could easily do.
Well, what this all has done, Jerry, is it's made for a very close election next Tuesday.
And I want to tell one more thing here, George, that is very important, and that is you saw Peter Thiel appear today. He was on Drudge, and he made some public statements. Well, his software, which is called Palantir, after some seeing stones in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, is being used by the FBI to go through these 600 and some thousand emails. Now, this Palantir software is extremely powerful. It finds connections and networks, say, between criminal syndicates that may be included in databases that are this complex. And I think Peter Thiel's appearance today was not accidental, because what the FBI is going to find in going through all these emails are, and by the way, Palantir was also sponsored by the Clinton Foundation and was part of the Clinton Global Initiative, and those who operated Palantir have inside information on how the Clinton Foundation works.
Yes, what a time it's going to be. How are Partners in Crime? How's the book doing?
The book is doing extremely well, Joseph, and I, you know, it predicted and shows the connections of the Clinton Foundation into the pay-for-play and inurement riching themselves. And I kind of want to leave you with one thing to watch, because this is going to be a week of bombshells, but the internal word developing is that this Danny Williams, press conference tomorrow, the guy who claims to be the son of the black son of Bill Clinton,
right,
is going to be
right.
Dynamite.
It's going to be
and
a big story.
By Friday, John Podesta may resign.
Oh, you think so?
I think so.
That's a huge story.
By Friday.
They're all huge stories.
They're all huge stories.
Can you make a prediction yet on what's going to happen next Tuesday?
Yeah, Hillary Clinton's going to lose.
You think so?
Yes.
Okay, and you're going to be with us on election night, right?
Yes, I will be.
Okay, thanks. Jerome Corsi. He called me Joseph a couple times. That's the guy he works with, Joseph Farah. I do think we look alike somehow. You might remember the movie The Birds. The really attractive girl in the movie was Tippi Hedren. I had a crush on her, and I was just a teenager. Well, apparently so did Alfred Hitchcock, but he went a little further. Apparently, actress Tippi Hedren has claimed that Alfred Hitchcock sexually harassed her while they worked together in the 1960s. Writing in her autobiography, she claimed the director threw himself on top of her in the back of his limousine and tried to kiss her. The actress described the encounter as an awful, awful moment. Hedren added that she did not tell anyone because sexual harassment and stalking were terms that didn't exist in the early 1960s. A Pizza Hut employee shot and killed a man during an attempted armed robbery after hours at the store early Sunday morning in West Charlotte, North Carolina. Officers were called there to the report of a shooting, and they found the individual that he had been shot. He was pronounced dead at the scene. According to police, three people entered the restaurant. They were in the process of robbing the business when one of the employees fired his own personal handgun at one of the suspects. Almost two dozen people at Martinsville Speedway in Virginia hurt after a driver ran into the crowd after a NASCAR race. Police said that they took the unnamed driver into custody for questioning. A new study by a prominent Russian astrophysicist claims that the new little ice age started at the end of 2015 due to low solar activity, kicking off now decades of deep cooling in the latter half of the 21st century. Years ago, Robert Felix, author of Not by Fire, But by Ice, called it on this very program that we are in the early stages of a little ice age. The mysterious tilt of the moon's orbit might have come from an angled giant impact that vaporized most of the early Earth, creating the moon in the process, according to a new study. What else is going on in the sky? Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, George. Happy Halloween to you.
You too.
Wonderful night it'll be. You know, we do the live sky here, and purposely, George, because November is just upon us, just on the other side of midnight for many. But here's some of the things that people can see, and they're pretty easy to follow. We begin just tomorrow evening, or tonight, depending on where you're listening. If you look out into the southwestern sky, both Venus and Saturn form a beautiful conjunction in the southwestern sky. Then follow that up on the 2nd of November, the Moon will be very close to Saturn, another conjunction. Then on the 3rd of November, the Moon is extremely close to the brilliant planet Venus, very easy to see with the naked eye. And then on the 6th, we have the Moon near the planet Mars. But George, two important meteor showers, one very famous and one not so famous. On the morning of the 12th, if people look into the eastern sky for the Taurid meteor shower, it's known for slow-moving and very bright fireballs, and we love those on coast to coast. Also, the 17th, we find out the annual Leonid meteor shower, the morning of the 17th into the east before dawn. The Moon might interfere a bit. But George, probably the showstopper of all of November has to be the beautiful supermoon that'll occur on the night of November the 13th into the 14th. We haven't seen a moon this close to the Earth, and we'll talk about it again next week, I'm sure, since January the 24th of 1948, some 221,524 miles away. And to put that into perspective during this particular part of the show, it would take you driving 75 miles an hour, still 123 days just to get to the moon, if you could even do that, that close. And then there's something really cool as we end this particular edition. We find, George, the moon and Jupiter are close on the 25th. But folks, if you look into the morning sky, something strange is happening on Jupiter. One of its belts, called the North Temperate Belt, bright storms are taking place, and observers around the world are noticing this in the telescope. A new moon by the 29th starts it all over, so November is great. And Dr. Sky reminds everyone, always remember to keep your eyes to the sky.
And is it true that you've been walking around dressed as a Klingon today?
Absolutely. I do have a Klingon spaceship right next to me, George. How amazing that you would figure that out.
I can remote view you. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank
Dr.
you.
Cates, Stephen. Stephen Cates, great guy. Okay, in a moment, Vampires Among Us, an incredible work by Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and that's next on Coast to Coast AM. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, a leading paranormal researcher, investigator, author of more than 60 books. She's my co-author with Talking to the Dead. She has done groundbreaking research on the djinn, shadow people, negative hauntings, dreams, and experiences. We're talking about her latest work called Vampires Among Us. Rosemary, happy Halloween.
And same to you, George.
Did you dress up?
Good time.
Did you dress up?
I did. I've been in Salem for the past week. And both Joe and I have been here. We did two balls. We did the Witch's Ball and the Hawthorne Ball. We were out tonight. And both of us were in costume for a good chunk of the weekend.
But you're not a witch, are you?
Well, I dressed up as one. I went as the Wicked Witch for one of the witch's balls.
Have you ever cast a curse or a spell?
Well, spell casting is a projection of will and intention for any purpose, including bringing bounty and good luck, and I've certainly done that. But cursing is not a good idea because it really boomerangs back on you. And I've always felt very strongly about practices that involve cursing other people or situations.
I want to get into your book, Vampires Among Us. But, of course, this being Halloween, I got to ask you a little bit about that. Why do people wear Halloween costumes? How did that tradition happen?
It actually probably goes back to very ancient times. The Festival of the Dead, Samhain as it's called in Gaelic, goes back thousands of years and was practiced by the Celts too, marking the end of harvest and the onset of winter. And there were beliefs that at this time the veil between the worlds was very thin and that spirits could come into the land of the living and also spirits of the dead. And so practices evolved over time involving getting dressed up in disguises so that the spirits wouldn't recognize you and they wouldn't cause you trouble, practices of leaving food, of offerings out to them as well to placate them. Leaving food for the dead is a very ancient custom, but at this particular time, these practices started to really become commonplace right around the 16th century. And they've become more embedded into our culture on both sides of the Atlantic. Because spirits were in the land of the living, they had the capability of causing mischief. And so that's also one of the practices related to trick-or-treating, that people would beg for food in order to please the spirits. And if they didn't get food, then they would play tricks. And so that's where trick-or-treating really got its earliest start.
Well, it's a great time of the year, Rosemary, because it really starts to kick off the holiday season. Once you get into Halloween, of course, Thanksgiving is right around the corner, then Christmas, then New Year's. It's a great time of the year, isn't it?
It is. It's really my favorite time of the year. I like the turn of the weather. There really is a feeling that you're closer to the spirit world at this time. The world of nature begins to quiet down, and we feel a little closer to the land of the dead and the land of spirits. So I think Halloween actually is an important observation. It's a good to practice some sort of remembrance for the dead. And I've done that here in Salem as well. I've had two events. One I lead myself, which is a night of black mirror gazing to contact the dead. And then I also participate in another ritual called the Dumb Supper, which is a meal that is served and eaten backwards and in silence.
How do you eat a meal backwards?
Well, you start
with
dessert.
Do you stand to it with your back to the plate and then you try to eat it that way?
It's served in reverse order, and the silverware is reversed. You eat in silence, and while you are eating, you are contemplating your relationship with your dead loved ones. And there's a place set for the dead at the Dumb Supper that Joe and I were at. There was an altar set up, and people brought photographs and mementos of friends and loved ones, even pets who had passed on. And it's a really emotional experience.
So it's really taken seriously, isn't it?
It is.
The Dumb Supper.
The Dumb Supper is something that I think has evolved a lot in about the last century or so. Nobody really knows exactly how old it is. There have been folklore customs of eating meals in silence and backwards in order to get information from the dead. But it's been in the last century or so that it's coalesced into a custom of remembrance, especially at Halloween time.
Okay, Rosemary, let me ask you about the name of the book, Vampires Among Us. That kind of implies that they're everywhere.
Well, they are, and nobody actually knows exactly how many vampires there are. There are many different kinds of vampires, and Vampires Among Us is a long-term project that I've had for decades to research folklore about vampires, the returning dead, spirit vampires, and then just in recent times, the past several decades, a growing culture of people who consider themselves to be living vampires. And it's really quite an interesting scene. Nobody knows exactly how many living vampires there are. There are probably tens of thousands of them around the world, at least 5,000 or more in the United States alone. But the dead, the returning dead and the spirit vampires, those have been with us throughout human history.
Interesting take. And what are some real characteristics of vampires?
Well, with the returning dead, these would be people traditionally who suffered unhappy, tragic deaths, very bad accidents, perhaps violent deaths in war. They were murdered, suicide victims, and especially in parts of Eastern Europe, there were old beliefs that such people were in danger of not passing over into the afterlife, and that they were capable, the spirit was capable of remaining in the grave with the corpse. The corpse would not decompose and would serve as a vehicle to sustain the spirit, which could escape the grave and go out and pester the living, literally vampirizing their life force, drinking their blood, causing all sorts of havoc in the world. And there were customs then of finding the corpse of the vampire, digging it up, and if it was undecomposed, then that was a sign that that person was indeed a vampire, and the corpse would be mutilated or even destroyed, which would end the activity of the spirit. Then there are also non-human vampires.
Hold on for that, Rosemary. We'll come back in a moment. We'll talk more about Vampires Among Us. Coast to Ghost continues in the next hour. Ghost to Ghost begins. And our special guest this hour, Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Next hour, Ghost to Ghost begins. And we've got some special things cooked up for you next hour when Ghost to Ghost starts. It's always a fun time, Rosemary, isn't it?
It is, and I do enjoy the haunted activities. And you know, here in Salem, it's a very haunted place. And I've had some ghost experiences here. I've been researching the hauntings, most of which go back to the witch trials here. But a lot of the old houses are quite active.
How close has Hollywood gotten to the real vampire types?
Well, actually, not very.
What do you mean?
Well, the vampire that's portrayed in the films started with Bram Stoker's Dracula, which was not quite an accurate portrayal of real vampires. Stoker fictionalized a lot. And over the course of time, the vampire became more glamorous, was an actual kind of undead person that slept in dirt or a coffin and bit everybody on the neck to drink blood, became more alluring, even more glamorous. And by the time we get to the 1970s with the novels of Anne Rice, the popular culture portrayal of vampires is vastly different than the horrible monster that our ancestors of several hundred years ago perceived. So it's been quite a transformation.
Vampires, of course, and we're talking about how do you destroy them and what Hollywood does, you know, put a stake through their heart and things like that. How do you destroy a vampire?
The belief from the old times that the undecomposed corpse literally was the food for the vampire, the spirit to leave the grave. And so if you destroyed the corpse, then you destroyed the ability of the spirit to leave the grave. And putting a stake into either the gut or the heart, where the seat of the soul would be. The heart, of course, which would keep a body alive. The gut, which is considered a seat of the soul as well. Also, slashing the soles of the feet or cutting the Achilles tendons, cutting off the feet, the hands, cutting off the head of the corpse. These were all ways that destroyed the ability of the spirit to literally walk in the land of the living. And the most extreme solution would be to cut up the corpse and cremate it into ash and then throw the ash into running water.
We're going to take some calls with you this half hour, Rosemary. What's remaining, of course. Where did the idea of vampires and blood come in?
Well, people felt if they were attacked by vampires, they would be usually attacked while they were asleep, although vampires could be out during the day. I'm going back to the old folklore accounts from several hundred years ago, and people would feel weak and exhausted, and sometimes they would have some sort of evidence that they had been wounded during the night, and so the vampire was taking the life force, which would be the blood. But vampires could also take the life force in other ways. We find records of vampires, for example, vampirizing beauty, vampirizing the ability of animals to provide sustenance for people, hens not to lay eggs, cows not to give milk, crops to wither and die. And even in certain parts of the world, vampires would take fat instead of blood because that would be what would endanger people's ability to stay alive. So the idea of the blood-drinking vampire, that blood would be the only thing that vampires would take, is a notion that really got purveyed in film and fiction in the last century or so.
What's your favorite vampire movie?
My favorite vampire movie portrays vampires as they probably really were in the old view, and that's Nosferatu.
Ah, that's one of the originals, a black and white movie, right?
Black and white, it was a silent film. Done in the 1920s, it was actually a plagiarism of Stoker's novel Dracula.
That was one ugly vampire, Rosemary.
Exactly. And that's how our ancestors described vampires, is that they were monstrous, they were ugly, they were even demonic in appearance, and had none of the allure of Dracula or later vampires. They were unholy things that were reviling, and you didn't want any sort of contact with it. They were deadly, absolutely deadly. And the performance that Max Schreck gave as the vampire in that film, which was then repeated by Klaus Kinski in 1979 in a remake, both of those performances, very good. The vampire is pale, looks more animalistic than human, has rat fangs rather than sharp canines. And rat fangs could do some damage.
Oh, yeah.
Blood drinking.
Is it possible for a human being to be turned into a vampire, or is that Hollywood again?
Well, actually, in olden times, yes, people did believe that if you were attacked by a vampire and then you died, that you were then in danger of becoming a vampire yourself. And this was one of the explanations for how epidemics spread, fatal epidemics. And this entered then popular culture through literature, and Dracula, for example, turns his victims into vampires. He drinks their blood, and then they become vampires after death. And with the more modern fiction, then we have these rituals of turning vampires, where people would be drained of their blood almost to the point of death, and then they would drink the blood of the vampire, and that would transform them into an immortal being, an entirely separate, almost like a separate species. And there are people in the living vampire culture today who have various practices of taking either energy or blood, which they believe does sustain them in very important ways.
We're with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Her website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, visionaryliving.com. Her book, a brand new one, is called Vampires Among Us. Let's take some calls. West of the Rockies, Jack in Goleta, California, is with us. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I want to tell you one quick vampire story.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I was a weird kid. I used to hang out with near my elementary school, Santa Monica, in Hollywood, at its forever now cemetery that was called the Holly Memorial.
Uh-huh.
And that's where Alfalfa was buried. And I was a kid, oh, look, there's Alfalfa. And my friends and I would have duck egg fights there. And, you know, we were around Douglas Fairbanks' grave and Tyrone Power. I was a weird kid at 10 years old. So I'm, you know, by myself at night, and I'm walking by the cemetery, and I swear there's this guy, and he scared me. I screamed like a little girl. He had fangs, and he vampire, and he rah, and I ran home screaming like a little girl. Now I laugh. This studio, Paramount, is down the street. And if you see Ed Wood like Vampira, I was explaining to my daughter the other day, I'm going, see how Vampira is? I said, that's what this guy probably did. Left Paramount Studios,
yep,
had his makeup on, and I'm going to scare this bejesus out of this kid. Well, he did, and that's my vampire story.
I love it. I love it. Hey, thanks for sharing that with us, Jack. That's a cool story, isn't it?
That is. It's funny.
Those things happen, too. People in costume. You know, right now during Halloween, Rosemary, people are really concerned about these clowns.
I have been doing some investigation on the whole phantom killer clown phenomenon, too. And in fact, I'm now executive editor of Fate magazine, by the way.
I heard that. Congrats.
Thank you. I've been associated with Fate for a couple decades now in various capacities. And I'm doing a major story on phantom clowns. And there is a paranormal phenomenon that's related to clowns. And these would be like trickster figures. They would have grotesque appearances that would do weird things. There have been, I think, a fair number of genuine supernatural phantom clown reports. And I think this is all tied into the trickster archetype and the trickster phenomenon. But then now we have a lot of hoaxing going on, where people have been playing upon those fears and the publicity that's been going around in the media. And that's a whole different dangerous phenomenon. But people have profound fears of clowns. This is a very old fear. In fact, some experts say that fear of clowns even ranks above fear of public speaking.
I don't like clowns. And I've been saying that since I've been doing this program. I just don't like them. They just are creepy. I don't know if it was Stephen King's It, but I just don't like clowns. I did like a little clown when I was a kid, Emmett Kelly. He looked like a little hobo clown. But after that, didn't like him.
Pretty, benign. But Stephen King really, I think, captured clown fear with Pennywise. And the clowns are unpredictable. They're human, but they're not human. And in psychology terms, this puts people into kind of a liminal state of not knowing what to expect. And they do look dangerous because their features are exaggerated and grotesque. And their behavior is unpredictable. And many children do fear clowns, and this fear does last into adulthood.
We're going out to Delaware. Jim's with us. Jim, you're on the show with us. Go ahead.
Hey, George.
Hi, Jim.
The Bible says life is in the blood, so no wonder vampires suck blood.
You got it.
A lot. Hey, Rosemary, do you know the story of Tam Lin?
I've forgotten a lot of the details of it.
T-A-M-L-I-N.
Tam Lin. No, I haven't heard of that.
In Irish folklore, that's what I was under the impression.
I don't know. Have you heard of that, Rosemary? It's been a while.
Yeah, I have, but I can't recall the particulars of it right now, I'm afraid.
Lots of different myths, though, out there, aren't there?
Yes, and there are a lot of characters in our folklore that are vampire-like in nature because they take something from the living that endangers the ability of the living to survive. And it doesn't necessarily have to be blood. It really boils down to the life force or whatever it is that enables your survival. And that's why the blighting of the crops and the damage to livestock and things like that were just as precarious in terms of survival to people in earlier times as something that would literally take blood from the person. And so vampires take the vital life force, and the most dramatic way is the blood, of course. And there are spirits, vampiric spirits as well, that will suck off the life force from people through attachment. And the shedding of blood in a lot of rituals to propitiate spirits and gods releases a life force that the belief is that the spirits or the gods will take that energy from the release of the life force.
Yeah, Tam Lin is a Scottish myth, of course, of someone who collects a maiden and captures them. I guess it scared a lot of people in those days. Paul in Sailorville, New Jersey. Hey, Paul, go ahead.
Yes, good evening. How are you?
Great, Paul.
First time caller, long time listener.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, I was curious when you were speaking there about the vampires. A couple of years ago, in fact, it was 4 years ago this week when we were hit by Sandy, the storm. Things were really bad. It was a lot of people, including myself, who was out of work because their businesses were either washed away or too damaged that they wouldn't allow you in there. A very good friend of mine who was a contractor, he asked me if I could use the work. I said, sure. He was a sheetrocker. We had to drive down the shore every day, and when we did, I asked him, I said, I'm surprised that you don't have enough help, but, you know, all of these people, he says, well, we got a fellow named Charlie working for us. He says, you'll meet him. He says, in fact, he's the one who's been lining up the jobs. He says, and a couple of guys, they don't want to work with him. He says, he's not a very talkative guy. He's not mean or anything like that, but they just feel really creepy around him. Well, I didn't think twice about it. I needed the money. It was a good day's pay, and I began to work with this fella, and it seemed like anytime we had a break or we had a stop for some reason, be it lunch or whatever, he would just sit across the room, legs crossed, and he would sit there and stare at me. And
a little unnerving, isn't it?
A bit. And I'm thinking, well, this is it. This is why this fellow, you know, these other people didn't want to work with the guy. He doesn't have much of a, if he was a doctor, he wouldn't have no bedside manner, put it that way. And I come to realize by the third day of this that instead of feeling energized after eating lunch and taking a break, I was more or less, I felt like I was drained, like I needed a nap. And he says, I had mentioned that to the fellow I was working for, and he says, well, that's why those other guys didn't want to work with Charlie anymore. They swore that he was draining their energy.
A psychic vampire. And let's talk a little bit about that. Thanks, Paul, by the way. Psychic vampires, Rosemary, they're just as lethal as the real ones.
Oh, they certainly are, and probably far more common in modern times. Some people are unwitting psychic vampires, and they have the ability to just drain you of all your energy just by being around them, and they don't really realize what they're doing. Other people know how to do it quite deliberately, and they have learned techniques for drawing energy from you so that they use it to become more energized and enlivened themselves.
Well, that's exciting stuff. Rosemary, people need to get a hold of you. Where do they go?
VisionaryLiving.com. I have a brand new website, got a whole new look, and a new material.
With everything that you've done, in terms of, and you've done a lot, the gin, vampires, you name it, you've done it. What scares you the most?
The gin. Still the gin.
Okay.
I think that they are the most formidable and dangerous negative entities out there. Not all gin are negative, but they have been mixing it up with people as long as we've been on the planet. A lot of them are hostile to us. They're shapeshifters. They attach to people. Every day I get emails from people who describe cases of very serious lifelong attachments and difficulties that can be ascribed to the jinn. And that's one of the reasons why I've been researching them and writing on them for some years now.
Well, you keep doing what you're doing. How long are you going to stay out there in that area?
We are leaving Salem on Wednesday. We'll have been here a week. And then I have a few events around the East Coast before I wrap it up at Thanksgiving and take a little break.
It's amazing. We're talking about Thanksgiving already, isn't it?
I know. It'll be here tomorrow, practically.
You got it. Rosemary, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the week, okay?
Thank you, and happy Halloween, George.
You too. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, up next on Coast to Coast AM, we begin Ghost to Ghost. Opening up the phone lines, I want you to share with us your incredible ghost stories. We'll be right back.